Good morning. Happy Mother's Day. Welcome to the First Parish Church of Stowe and Acton on this very special Sunday in so many ways. It's the beginning of candidating week with Reverend Cynthia Landrum. My name is Carolyn Zettler, and I currently serve on the Board of Trustees. We welcome Reverend Cindy. We are sure you're as excited as we are about this coming week. We have a packed schedule at FPC this week, and the full details of all the candidating week activities are included in your order of service. In particular, next Sunday, there will be one service only at 10 o'clock, and this will be followed by a special and very important congregational meeting at 11:30 a.m., for which child care will be provided. Coffee hour follows this service in Fellowship Hall. Exit through the door to my left. Follow the hallway to the end. The signs will direct you. I don't think Reverend Cindy will make it to coffee hour today, as she will be heading to RE classes to meet with the children.
Nope, that was only first service.
Oh.
I'll be there.
Okay. With good luck, we have Reverend Cindy will be there at coffee hour.
We're going to have a little corner that I'll be in, and you can come over and coffee.
Thank you. If you are a guest with us this morning, we are very glad you are here. Welcome. Please join us for coffee hour. Child care is available during the service on the lower level of Fellowship Hall. An usher can assist you in finding the way. The FPC plant sale takes place today between 10 and 1 in front of the carriage shed. I'm sure you noticed. You'll find wonderful additions for your garden, your home, or to give to a friend. Now I'd like to call on Sharon for a special announcement.
Good morning. My name is Sharon Brownfield, and I've had the privilege of chairing your Settled Minister Search Committee. As you all know, we have been working for the last year to find a minister to guide this church. When I say this church, I mean you and I and the rest of the congregation. We spent the first half of our search process questioning you and eliciting your ideas and desires, and then the second half, you're finding a minister who would best fit our particular personality. That was a challenge because we have a rather high aspirations. Fortunately, we had excellent candidates who were interested in our church, and we believe we have found just the person. While we were looking for the ideal person, Cindy Landrum was looking for a ministry which, in her own words, and I quote, appreciates my strengths in preaching, administration, community organizing, and social justice. And for my family, I am looking for a congregation with strong religious education. I hope for a congregation that has a vibrant role in the community, or wants to have one, and which believes Unitarian Universalism has an important message to share. Cindy's record substantiates her skills. She has served as minister for the Universalist Unitarian Church of East Liberty in Clark Lake, Michigan, for the past 14 years, and now desires to apply her skills in a larger church. She is no stranger to New England, having served the Unitarian University Society in Gardner, and has family in Rhode Island. She has established herself as a deep thinker in the world of UU ministers and has published thoughtful pieces in UU World. She is a thinker and an actor, an advocate for social justice, a communicator, and we feel the Reverend Dr. Cynthia Landrum is ideally suited to partner with us here at First Parish to do everything that we wanted it to be. So I present to you Cynthia.
Thank you. Thank you for such a warm welcome, and thank you to the search committee for selecting me. I feel like the luckiest minister in the UUA because, from what I could tell, you are the most awesome church in the UUA. And I had high standards because I had a church I loved, and was happy there, but it was the right time for me to move. But I had very high standards, and you met every bar that I could set and then went way beyond as well. So I'm very privileged to be here. I look forward to meeting you all throughout this week, and I'm meeting some of you in social hour, and meeting some of you right now. Let's greet our neighbors. Opening words come from Shel Silverstein, the children's poet. If you are a dreamer, come in. If you are a dreamer, a wisher, a liar, a hoper, a prayer, a magic bean buyer. If you are a pretender, come sit by my fire, for we have some flax golden tales to spin. Come in, come in. Now I'd like to invite the search committee members who are here this morning to come forward and light our chalice. And if you would repeat some chalice lighting words back as I say them, that would be wonderful. Because I didn't realize they were supposed to be printed in the order of service, so live and learn. We light this chalice,
we light this chalice
for the light of knowledge,
the warmth of community,
and the fire of commitment.
And the fire of commitment.
Thank you. Our opening hymn is number 1003, Where Do We Come From? And Mike's going to explain to you how we're going to do this.
Good morning, everyone. So we have a canon this morning, but it's not your average canon. This canon is written so that you each section of people keeps repeating the same line, sort of like a mantra. And then we add our own line to it as we go. So here's how we'll do this. We'll all sing this number 1003 together one time, okay? And then we'll start over here. This is going to be with the choir. Circle one. Good. Yeah, they're excited. Okay. This is circle one, okay? So you sing circle one and keep repeating it. This is after we do the whole thing once, okay? This is going to be circle two right here, circle three, and circle four. So that's your line after we sing it through once that we keep repeating. Got it? Good luck. Here we go. Please rise in body or spirit and join in singing.
Where do we come from? What are we? Where are we going? Where do we come from? Mystery, mystery. Life is a riddle and a mystery. Where do we come from? Where are we going?
Circle one.
Where do we come from? What are we? Where are we?
Repeat that. Circle two.
Where do we come from? Mystery, mystery. Life is a riddle and a mystery. Where come from? Where are we going? Where do we come from? Where are we going?
One more time.
Where do we come from? Where are we going?
Nice job. Thank you. Please remain standing for our covenant and affirmation.
That's right. Please join in our covenant. Love is the,
spirit of this church, and service its law. This is
our great covenant, to dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in love, and to help one another.
Extravaganza. I've been looking forward to this.
All right. Well, we want to welcome you, Cindy. And I'm the Director of Religious Education. We met at 9 o'clock. And I just want to tell you, we're so happy to have you here that we actually made the theme of our RE Extravaganza to RE Happy, or as in Be Happy. And I'm just wondering, do you need help in any way?
Yes, actually, I do need some help because this is, of course, my first time here, and my family's here with me. And so can you tell me some more about the RE program? I've read about it, but I know there's a lot happening on Sunday morning.
There is. I think the best way for you really to find out about our RE program is to have the ball of RE happiness and knowledge, and it will speak to you and let you know about our programs.
Now, what do I do with this ball?
You just put it over your head or on your head. And state loudly, ball of RE happiness and knowledge, please tell me what goes on in RE.
Okay, this sounds like something you do to newcomers to make them look goofy.
No.
But I'm going to do it. Everybody get your cell phones ready. Ball of RE happiness and knowledge, tell me more about the RE program.
Who has RE? Oh, that's Marion. Marion, stand up. And we now catch the ball.
I'm here to say we offer classes to 8 different groups of children and youth every Sunday.
Junior youth.
That's over to Sheena, Marion, over here.
Oh. We have an active junior group for youth in grades 6 to 8. It meets twice a month. It's really great.
Senior youth!
Sheena Tafay.
I can get that side. Sorry. I'll take this side.
We didn't meet very much this year, but next year Paul has big plans that will soon appear.
Love you.
Right over here to Reagan. Ooh, good catch.
This is for kids in grades K to 5, one time a month on Friday night. It is so much fun, especially hide and seek without any light.
Music program!
Oh, throw it right here to Mike.
Yes. We have choir for our children in grades 1 through 4 that meets on almost every Sunday morn. For those in grades 5 through 8, we are planning a new music program where youth will have a say, as it is time for this program to be reborn.
All the way to Hector.
And our whole programs for 5th through 6th and 7th through 8th grade every other year. They are wonderful programs, even though they often fill the kids with fear.
Oh, that's right to Jillian. That's not a very far throw.
This is a special program for kids in grades 2 to 4 where they get to learn about being UU and much more.
Tamasha.
This is the favorite program for those in 9th through 12th grade where topics are discussed and friendships are made.
And last but not least, coming of age.
All the way up here.
This is a rite of passage for those in grades 9 and 10. It culminates with each youth giving a credo in front of families and friends.
And then can you throw the ball of knowledge back to Reverend Cindy?
Right. So that was really wonderful, great information. But, oh, magic ball of knowledge and happiness, can you tell me more about how this is all accomplished? Because surely Michelle doesn't do it alone.
I don't. I'm good, but not that good. So the RE and committee and I could never create this much happiness on our own. We believe here at FPC that our children and youth are part of our FPC village and that everyone helps to raise them. We ask all families to give 15 hours a year to our village education program. We also have many people that volunteer, even though they don't have kids in the program. And just at this point, I'd like to show Reverend Cindy how many people make our program happy by and our families happy by volunteering. So if you served as a mentor, a substitute, a teacher, a coming-of-age leader, a high school discussion leader, can you just stand up? Oh, senior youth advisors, junior youth advisors, of course. Yes, please, stand up.
Mummers play.
All right. If you look around, oh, yeah, and RE committee members should certainly be standing up as well. And this is just a small amount of people that help. We have over, I think, 100 volunteers each year that give back to our program. And
yeah, thank you for doing that work. That's an amazing group of volunteers and definitely makes me feel this don't worry, be happy vibe because that's amazing. Thank you.
And is it great to see that we have that much interest in our children and youth? And we also hope that today we're doing our RE extravaganza, which is really a fancy term for RE registration. We ask that all the families fill in their forms today. Now, some of you, senior youth, might be interested in prizes, but I bet the younger ones, and this is shameless manipulation of parents, I'll be up there. So if you fill in your form, and your parents fill in the form and hand it in, you get a prize. So please, please encourage your parents to fill in their forms. And also, if there's anyone that knows, like, you know what, I really want to give back to this program, but I don't have kids, please see someone at the table, and they'll ask you to fill in just the portion of the form for volunteering. So that's it, Cindy.
Thank you. My family and I feel very welcome now. Hey, Katie.
Yeah?
Did your dad get you registered in the first social hour?
Yeah.
You got your prize?
Yeah.
Awesome, because we are definitely planning on being part of the next education year here at FPC.
And please remember, don't drop the ball on this. Get your forms in today. And parents, remember to get your kids, get your parents on the ball and have them fill in the forms. And don't worry, RE happy.
I can see I'm really going to have a ball here. Now, before we send the children and youth and their teachers out to this fabulous RE program, we want to spend a few minutes in recognition of Mother's Day and of the many types and forms that parenting takes. So this is going to involve a little less ball tossing, but I want to recognize different kinds of parents. When I mention a group that involves you, I'd like for you to stand or wave or otherwise signal to people that you're included here, and if you're comfortable. And I'm going to ask you all to say after it, We recognize you and honor you today. Can you practice that? We recognize you and honor you today. And I'll just gesture like that when it's your line. So for mothers who stay home and mothers who work, mothers with young children, mothers with children who are grown, for mothers of all shapes and sizes and ages and races and sexualities and more, for mothers who give birth and mothers who adopt, mothers who foster, today is a day we often recognize you, and for good reasons. Your strength, your love, your blessings to the next generation are worth honoring. Please stand as we say, we recognize you and honor you today. And for fathers out there, because we know that in Unitarian Universalism, Father's Day falls right before General Assembly, you often don't get the recognition you deserve. And particularly fathers who are raising their children on their own and for two father families, we know that you are important, and we give you today, too, our thanks and recognition. Mothering and fathering and parenting is about relationship, and that transcends gender. And also for our genderqueer parents, transgender parents, and parents who defy categories and definitions, but who often go unrecognized. In this faith, we see you, we honor you, and we thank you too. Please rise. We recognize you and honor you today. And for the older generations who parent, the grandparents and aunts and uncles and cousins and others, some who have sometimes taken in children and become parents and guardians, and for those who reach across the generations to offer support and guidance, we are ever so grateful. These children take a village. Will you please rise? We recognize you and honor you today. Thank you. We know that motherhood and parenthood, too, is often about loss and sadness, and it can be a hard day on a day that holds so much celebration and happiness for some. We need to recognize the pain that is here, too. So now I invite you to change your response to, we recognize you and hold you in our heart. We recognize you and hold you in our heart. So for mothers and all parents who have given children up for adoption, for parents who have lost their children through death or miscarriage or through broken relationship, through the foster system, through other ways in which parent and child are disconnected from one another, we see you too. We recognize you and hold you in our heart. And for children and adults who are without their mothers today, whether that is from death or broken relationship or the violence of body or spirit, we see your pain and struggle. We recognize you and hold you in our heart. And for those who wish to be parents but are not yet or may never be, we hear your heartbreak and your struggle. We recognize you and hold you in our heart. Parenting is complex. It is never as simple as advertisements and card aisles will have us believe. This day brings joy and it brings pain. Whatever your story, whatever your relationship to the generations before and after, we see you here. We honor you here. Here, your story can be heard. We recognize you and hold you in our heart. May it be so. Amen. Please join me in a moment of prayer or meditation as we turn our thoughts inward for silent reflection with these words. Spirit of life, we give thanks for the blessing of community this morning. The community of the Spirit that offers us sanctuary when we need a place where we can come and be our fullest selves, a refuge from a world filled with malice and anger and hatred and pain, a place where we can bring our full identities and all the questions of our spirit. A community of a Spirit that offers us comfort, a helping hand, a shoulder to cry on, a hug when needed, a personal touch in a world that can be cold and clinical, and a space for aloneness when the world presses in. A community of the Spirit which offers us community, friendship, activity, belonging, a place where we feel, when we feel alone, tasks to challenge us, to help us feel included, a network to rely on when times are rough. A community of the Spirit that offers us a calling in the greater world. Through our faith, we are called to justice, brought back into the world to be transformed and to transform it in turn. We give thanks for the blessings of community today. If you feel blessed by being here, may you pass those blessings on to others. If you're looking for community and its blessings and are seeking here today, we hope you find nourishment. Blessed be, and amen. So I notice that you call the offering sharing our gifts here. We do that in my congregation. It's called Gifts of the Congregation. And we do this because our sharing, the offering, is a gift. It's a gift we give ourselves. It's a gift we're giving to each other here in this room and those in this community. It's a gift we're giving to the larger world because it enables this church to do the work of justice in the larger world as well. And it's a gift that this month we're sharing with the Concord Prison Outreach. In this spirit of gift giving, we will now have the morning offering. If I wasn't already convinced that this was the most amazing church ever, that would have done it. Thank you. Our reading this morning is Mother Wisdom Speaks by Christine Lohr Weber. Some of you I will hollow out, I will make a cave. I will carve you so deep the stars will shine in your darkness. You will be a bowl. You will be a cup in the rock collecting rain. I will hollow you out with knives. I will not do this to make you clean. I will not do this to make you pure. You are clean already. You are pure already. I will do this because the world needs the hollowness of you. I will do this for the space that you will be. I will do this because you must be large, a passage. People will find their way through you, a bowl. People will eat from you, and their hunger will not weaken them to death, a cup to catch the sacred rain. My daughter, do not cry. Do not be afraid. Nothing you need will be lost. I am shaping you. I am making you ready. Light will flow in your hollowing. You will be filled with light. Your bones will shine. The round, open center of you will be radiant. I will call you Brilliant One. I will call you Daughter Who Is Wide. I will call you Transformed. Thus ends the reading. Our next hymn is number 391, Voice Still and Small. And since this is a meditative hymn, I invite you to either stand, if that's how you feel more meditative, sit, do whatever brings you into that meditative spirit. So I believe that there's an important link between creativity and the artistic and theology. For some people, that link is in the experience of the aesthetic, the beautiful, the sublime, that leads them to a greater understanding of the connection between humanity and the cosmos, or to God, or to the world of humanity. For me, as an agnostic, the arts were how I started connecting to the deep theological questions that I think are an important part of who we are as a faith and why we do this thing called religion. For me, it began in a high school class, my junior year in high school, in a class called Holocaust Literature. I didn't know it at the time, but my father had actually been transformed by his reading of Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning, in college, and it had led him to leave the path he was on of engineering and go into teaching as a profession to give back to the world and make it a better place. I didn't know that, but many years later, when studying Viktor Frankl and Elie Wiesel and Anne Frank, my life would take a turn as well. For me, the study of the Holocaust gave rise to a deep set of lasting questions that we call theodicy. Why does evil exist? Why do people do horrible things? What makes people become so inhumane? How can people do this to each other? How can God let evil exist? In Night, Elie Wiesel wrote this, and these words are a bit hard to hear. Never shall I forget that night, the first night in camp that turned my life into one long night seven times sealed. Never shall I forget the smoke. Never shall I forget the small faces of the children whose bodies I saw transformed into smoke under a silent sky. Never shall I forget those flames that consumed my faith forever. Never shall I forget the nocturnal silence that deprived me for all eternity of the desire to live. Never shall I forget those moments that murdered my God and my soul and turned my dream to ashes. Never shall I forget those things, even were I condemned to live as long as God himself. Never. Transmitted to me through Elie Wiesel's writings, these same questions and feelings would ultimately lead me into the call to ministry and are with me still. Today I read psychology, theology, science, philosophy, sociology, all still trying to understand how people are able to deny the basic humanity of others. Because it starts with othering, and it leads to denying the right to vote, to denying the right to citizenship, to equality, to marriage. It leads to slavery. It leads to building a wall. It leads to domestic violence and gun violence. It leads to the Holocaust, ultimately. There's a long way to go before you get to Holocaust, admittedly. It's true, but the path starts with othering, with scapegoating, with denying humanity. And I still ask, how do we start that hardening of the heart, and how do we stop it? So my path began with creativity, with the written word and that struggle with evil. And I studied the Bible for answers. But the Bible, ultimately, was just a set of stories to me. It was a book of a set of stories that were set out to answer these questions and others. And sometimes they were satisfactory, but sometimes they were not. For me, it mostly led to more questions. If there's a loving God, how do you explain what he did to Job? How do you explain the commandment to Abraham to sacrifice his son Isaac and lead him up to that point where he willingly binds up his son and prepares to kill him? How do you understand a God who would knowingly harden Pharaoh's heart and then, because Pharaoh wouldn't let the Jews go, kill all the firstborn sons of Egypt? How do we worship a God like that? And ultimately, the more I understood, the greatest question loomed. How could God need Jesus to die on the cross? Why is suffering required for redemption? How can innocent suffering ever be a requirement? Couldn't another way to salvation, a universalist way to salvation, be found? What sort of horrible cosmic equation and limited powers of God make that sacrifice necessary? Once one decides, as I did, that the stories of the Bible are just stories, they can still address some of the great questions, but their answers, for me, were not definitive. Once someone decides that, something else happens, or at least did for me. And that is that the world of stories opened up, and I found that stories of all sorts could hold answers just as readily. Why not, when thinking about the question of redemption, consider for yourself whether the ultimate redemption of Darth Vader or the ultimate lack of redemption of Lord Voldemort is a more satisfactory ending. Consider which one feels right, which one says more about the nature of humanity and of evil. Do you think evil is a force seducing you, drawing you to it like the One Ring to rule them all in Tolkien, or the White Queen Jadis of Narnia, offering you what you most desire, be it revenge or domination over your siblings, even if they are pesky, or Turkish delight? Turkish delight isn't that great. I had some at Christmas. For me, the most potent form of literature for exploring theological questions became science fiction and theology, science fiction and fantasy. Works that are more realistic can answer questions too. Certainly from Shakespeare to Hemingway, we are taught lessons through the literature about the nature of humankind. Death of a Salesman, for example, tells us about the modern condition. But for me, taking it to that fantastical limit is a way of exploring the limits of an idea. What better way to understand what humanity is than to compare it to alien life? So, for example, in Star Trek, which is not literature, I know, it's television, but again and again, we come up against alien beings, from the Vulcans to the Romulans to the Borg. And from each one, it asks us, what makes humanity unique? What makes us special? What are the essential values about the nature of humanity? In Star Trek, the answer is usually emotion and free will.
I wrote an article once about the religious values that I found in The Hunger Games. And the passage I find there most meaningful is where Katniss is meeting Peeta just before they go into the games to, you know, kill or be killed. And he says he's trying to think of how he can be himself in that battlefield arena, how he can show them that, quote, they don't own me. He says, I want to die as myself. A couple of years ago, I spent a year reading Dystopia for my study group that I'm in. I'm in the Ohio River Group. It's a study group for UU ministers. And our topic for the year was dystopia. And so I spent a year reading dystopian literature because I was writing a paper on a survey of dystopian literature. And we met to discuss these papers right after the election of Donald Trump. Never did a topic feel so prescient as discussing dystopia in the face of the election. Although it was pretty prescient when we chose race and then the Black Lives Matter movement roared into existence. But in that year of rereading and reading dystopia, I revisited one of my favorite books, which is Octavia Butler's The Parable of the Sower. In it, we have a dystopian future. It's written decades ago, but the president in that dystopian future talks about making America great again. It's a future where corporations have indentured servants and drugs and violence rule the streets. And in this dystopian future, a young woman becomes a prophet. She invents her own religion and starts sharing it. She calls it Earthseed, and she says, God is change. In one of her verses, she says, all that you touch, you change. All that you change, changes you. The only lasting truth is change. God is change. And if God is change, she tells us, we can shape God. We can change God. We are shapers. So I tell you, the theology of the parable of the sower makes more sense to me than the theology of Abraham binding up Isaac. It makes more sense as just as coherent and meaningful and plausible and profound as systematic theology or process theology or any of those great tomes by dead white men that I read in seminary. In theology school, though, I once heard about story theology. And when I heard the term, I was so excited. Somebody finally gets it. We can use stories as lenses through which to examine the big theological questions. But sadly, no, that is not what story theology is. It's all very biblical. I find theological explanation and exploration through story. But I want to pause here and say that it's not just story, of course. It can be music. I think of Depeche Mode's Blasphemous Rumors, which said, I think that God's got a sick sense of humor, and when I die, I expect to find him laughing. That was important scripture to me in college. Or it can be dance or art. Looking at Artemisia Gentileschi's Judith and Holofernes gives me a whole different understanding, a feminist understanding of the stories of the Hebrew Bible. There's one of her paintings of the beheading of Holofernes in the Detroit Institute of Arts. I recommend it to you if you're ever there. Or how Picasso's Guernica captures the violence and horror and chaos of war. That's a religious statement too, in a very different sort of way. So I focus on literature because it's my roots, but of course inspiration comes from lots of sources. To step back into the Holocaust literature for a moment, there's another way that this literature took me down this path, and that's through calling me to write. After reading The Diary of Anne Frank, I had a few dreams about the Holocaust sprinkled throughout my life. And the first one was about Anne Frank. And in this dream that I had in high school, I met Anne Frank, and in childish words, she impressed upon me the importance of me writing. It was a dream that would come back to me again and again, not in dream form, but in memory, urging me to write, compelling me to write, reminding me to write. Over and over again, I'd chide myself at the failure to produce more writing in a regular journal, and I'd remind myself of Anne Frank, who never got to grow up and become the writer that she could have been. Her writing was taken from her and her life. There are actually dozens of examples of teenage journals of Holocaust victims who did not get to live out their potential and share the writer's writing they could have written as adults with the world. To the extent that I am a preacher, it is because I was first a writer, and I was a writer first because of Anne Frank. And Anne Frank gave me the answer to that question of evil for she said these words, "In spite of everything, I still believe that people are really good at heart. I simply can't build up my hopes on a foundation consisting of confusion and misery and death. I see the world gradually turning into a wilderness. I hear the ever-approaching thunder, which will destroy us too. I can feel the suffering of millions. And yet, if I look up into the heavens, I think it will all come out all right, and that this cruelty will end, and that peace and tranquility will return again. And in the meantime," she says, "I must uphold my ideals, for perhaps the time will come when I shall be able to carry them out." These words were echoed for me later in the Unitarian Theodore Parker, who would say, "I do not pretend to understand the moral universe. The arc is a long one. My eye reaches but a little way. I cannot calculate the curve and complete the figure by the experience of sight. I can divine it by conscience. And from what I can see, I am sure that it bends towards justice." But if literature led me into the deepest theological questions, and I explored those questions well, it was poetry that finally called me to action. In poetry, I found the message that while it does matter what the cause of evil is and what the answers to that cause of evil are, there is one thing that is certainly the case, and that is we are required to take action. We are required to make our lives a force for good. And so in Christine Lohr Weber's poem, Mother Wisdom Speaks, she told me, "The world needs the hollowness of you. You must be large, a passage." And Mary Oliver asked me, "Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?" And she told me, "When it's over, I don't want to wonder if I have made of my life something particular and real." And she said, "Be ignited or be gone." Rebecca Parker, the Unitarian Universalist Theological School president who resigned a few years ago, said, "Your gifts, whatever you discover them to be, can be used to bless or curse the world." And concluded, "Choose to bless the world." UU minister Lynn Unger in her poetry says, "Make no mistake, of course your work will always matter." Rilke says, "You must change your life, want the change, be inspired by the flame, pour yourself like a fountain." And Rumi says, "There is a community of the spirit. Join it and feel the delight of walking in the noisy street and being the noise." And Sonia Sanchez said, in words put to music by Sweet Honey in the Rock, "I say come and return to the fight, this fight for the earth, this fight for our children, this fight for our life. We need your hurricane voices. We need your sacred hands. I say come, sister, brother, to the battlefield." And Maya Angelou said, "Give birth again to the dream. Women, children, men, take it into the palm of your hands and mold it into the shape of your most private need. Sculpt it into the image of your most public self." And Adrienne Rich lastly said to me, "I have to cast my lot with those who, age after age, with no extraordinary power, reconstitute the world." In Scripture, we're told over and over again of prophets who hear the calling of God. One is Samuel, who hears as a boy the calling of God and runs to his master thinking it's him. And his master, after a couple times of this, says, "Oh, it's God," and tells him the next time to say, "Here I am, Lord. I'm no prophet. I have never heard the word of God. But I hear the calling of others, these voices that speak to me through poetry and literature, and call me to pour my life like a fountain, to be ignited, to stay on the battlefield, to choose to bless the world. I'm called not by God, but through poetry and through story, to make a choice to reconstitute the world. As are you, whether you are called into your deepest being directly by God or into the work of justice through poetry and story or through gardening or dance or art or the natural world. Use your choice, your creativity, your passion to bless the world. May it be so." Our closing hymn is number 298, "Wake Now, My Senses."
This is our one wild and precious life. May we use it to be ignited, to stay on the battlefield, and to choose to bless the world. Go in peace. Please join in our sung benediction.